I suppose I should say that after you start recording, huh? I call this meeting of the GiveWell Board to order.
Thank you, Tim. All right, then I will take on my additional kickoff duty and just do a quick roll call. So we'll just go around and make sure all the members are here, and then I will also ask some of our new folks to quickly introduce themselves. So Tim Ogden.
Tim Ogden, Chairman.
Holden Karnofsky.
Yep.
Harry Tuna.
Present.
Ellie Hassenfeld, sorry.
Here.
Julia Wise.
Here.
And then we have a few additional people joining us for today's meeting. Whitney Schinkel, board advisor. Buddy Shaw, board advisor. And then prospective joiner, Norma Altshuler, and two of the GiveWell outreach staff members, Jim and Stephanie. So we will kick off the meeting. I did want to do a quick intro. Basically, when we sent out this agenda, we did want to kind of focus on the areas of key interest to board members. So, you know, thanks to all of the members and advisors for sharing comments and questions. I think that was super helpful. We did end up editing the agenda a little bit because of the clear focus on the outreach questions. So we actually allotted the first hour and 20 minutes for Q&A and divided that more heavily towards the outreach side of things. Before we dive into that, I just wanted to make sure we're basically planning to leave the last 10 minutes for the two votes. We expect that to be pretty quick because we didn't get any questions about them, but I wanted to make sure that that works for everybody and that there aren't any lingering questions out there on the vote items, just because we have not allotted a significant amount of time for that at the end. Was there anything that anyone wanted to raise on those? All right, if there are no key discussion points there, then we can kind of dive into the Q&A. We've divided the questions into outreach and COVID sections. There's sort of four subsections in outreach. So we tried to prioritize time on the things that we think will be most relevant to the full board and started with some sort of target definitions and source questions, then moving into the outreach approach and strategy more broadly, some donor retention tactics, and the marketing tactics. So Ellie and I will both kind of watch the clock and make sure that we're moving through these sections so that we don't miss any of the categories entirely. And then if we need to move on to COVID, we can always come back to outreach if there's more time or follow up offline as well. So we added about an extra 20 minutes to the outreach time, and then we'll move to COVID at 3:05. And we're going to just run through the questions that people submitted, but certainly feel free to interject additional or follow-up questions as we go, and I will make sure that we pause in case people have additional thoughts as they get information from primarily Jim, Steph, and Ellie. And we can get started. Any other meta thoughts before we dive in? Okay. We've kind of already done names, but I did want to just ask Jim, Steph, and Norma to just introduce themselves with sort of a little bit of background, and maybe if we go in that order, Jim, Steph, Norma, we can run through that quickly.
Sounds good. Thanks, Whitney. It's a pleasure to be here today. I've been with GiveWell about 6 months. Before joining GiveWell, it's been about 15 years. Is working at Capital One and Netflix, working within and then eventually building growth teams. And then over the past 6 years, pivoted my time to two startups, Citrus Lane, which was a box subscription service focused on new parents, and Texture, which was a digital magazine subscription that Apple purchased to cornerstone their News Plus service. Now, these are obviously not nonprofits, so maybe I'll take one more minute to just highlight what I'm hoping we can bring from those nonprofit worlds over to GiveWell. First, all of these experiences have been subscription-based, and I think What makes subscription companies unique is they are incredible aligning marketing spend with long-term payouts. By doing this, they can accelerate marketing, they can grow quickly, despite the fact that initially they may be costs. They may get less revenue than the cost of acquisition. But by having confidence in what lifetime values emerge, you can put the accelerator down on growth and drive a larger subscription base much more quickly. And I think that's something we can learn here at GiveWell. We have incredible loyalty, so it's clear that ongoing revenues is going to be a huge driver of our business. The better we can align to a multi-year LTV and control our marketing costs based on those ROI targets, our investment targets, I think we can accelerate the growth of this company. The second thing I think both Capital One and Netflix were particularly good at was using customer research to better understand how consumers think, what consumer groups are out there and we can go after next, how we need to evolve our voice and our message to better serve the consumer needs that are out there. I think most people here, based on conversations I've had with some of you, believe that the GiveWell promise is extendable far beyond the current audience. But to understand that, I think we need to talk more to donors, non-donors, understand what their needs are, and refine our business and our marketing messages to match their attitudes. And that's what we're going to be pursuing this year, is the build out of a marketing department that can be ROI centric and the build out of an insight group that can provide more basis of where we can navigate this company in the long term. So I look forward to talking about the outreach plan with you over the course of this meeting. Thank you.
You're muted.
Sorry, always do that. I'm on mute. I'm Steph. So I have been, I guess, a GiveWell donor, not quite since the early days, maybe 2015. And I have a more traditional background in fundraising. So did fundraising in the arts and higher education, two very impactful sectors for sure. And I guess when I joined GiveWell about a year ago, the open question was whether GiveWell donors, you know, would respond to traditional fundraising tactics and approaches. And based on the first year of work, I can confirm that indeed, yes, they do behave in the same ways. And so, you know, you've read the doc that shares a little bit more about the tactical plan for 2020 that we are hoping to roll out. And then, I guess a lot of the questions really do focus on a bit more of that long-term vision and growth trajectory, which we'll chat about in the Q&A. But yeah, that's me.
And can I just make a quick request? If you're not talking, would you mind muting? Because I think there's just some feedback that's coming and sort of chopping up the audio.
Is that, Whitney, it's your phone line?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And hi, I'm Norma Altshuler. Nice to see all of you and meet some of you. I, as Whitney said, have been having some exploratory conversations with Ellie and others about potentially joining the GiveWell board. And so I'm excited to have this opportunity to observe. I am a program officer at the Hewlett Foundation is my day job, and working on a portfolio of grant making called Evidence-Informed Policy. And before that, I've worked in other grant making gigs like the Global Innovation Fund and USAID's Development Innovation Ventures, and then in some research organizations and social enterprises, including GiveDirectly. So as you might imagine from this sorts of organizations, I've been a longtime GiveWell fan. So looking forward to this meeting.
Great. Thanks everybody. So I think without further ado, we will just dive into the Q&A. We really appreciate the questions. We gathered together them all together and are going to try to move through them in a coherent and hopefully, conceptual way. So we're going to start off with the outreach plan.
There isn't another document that we're supposed to be looking at, right?
There is no other document. No, this is just for our purposes to try and organize our answers to your questions. The most there may be a time or two where we like share our screen to show you some data, but mostly it's just going to be verbal. And this is intended to be similar to, you know, many of these Q&A board meetings we do, but just to organize the time a little bit more effectively. So we're going to start with the outreach goals document and focus on questions that just relate to definitions, estimates, like why we presented this information in this way and what it means. And I think we will probably allocate about 10 minutes, hopefully, to that topic. So Tim, you had asked just for some more information about, you know, why we were presenting this information in this way, combining both unrestricted donations and money moved into one table. You know, why did we go about it that way? And you also had questions about what the unattributed organic line meant, where those funds came from. And then you had asked about unexpected ultra high net worth, like what that meant and where that might come from. So I'll just address those briefly. So the reason we wanted to present both operational funding and money moved together is that when we look out at our budget needs for the next few years, we are going to need to proactively raise more money in order to have the staff that we want. And you know, a lot of that is staff on outreach expenses that will enable us to deliver the outreach results that we're aiming for. And so when we put together our targets, and especially when Stephanie puts together the major gifts targets, you know, we have a long list of donors from whom we intend to ask or to make large asks from over the next few years. And at this point, we haven't distinguished between people where the asks will be primarily operational or people where the asks will be primarily focused on money moved to top charities. This is just like, this is how we're viewing it internally. You know, we're saying in 2020, we need to move an incremental, or Stephanie needs to raise an incremental $3 million from major gifts. You know, in this year, that's mostly money moved, but by 2022, a significant portion of that is operational fundraising. And then just the other quick point is, you know, you had asked whether, you know, we normally are just sort of raising funds against our operating budget, and then we have an excess assets policy where at some point we would grant funds out. There's one exception to that where we would grant out money even if we didn't reach the like excess assets policy, which is, you know, we've agreed that we wouldn't accept more than 20% of our operating budget in any year from a single donor. So as you know, from past board meetings, there've been cases where we've granted out X funds from that individual donor, even when we haven't met our excess assets policy. And that's to enable GiveWell to maintain its independence, you know, and stability in the event that something about that donor's decisions change.
I mean, I do think, Elliot, would be helpful just for our understanding of this going forward to break out that unrestricted to GiveWell, how much of that is part of the projected and how much of the total going to charities is from the unrestricted bucket. Just as a way of understanding, you know, how money is coming in and where it's going. But, you know, I apologize for also not noticing this the first time, but in 2021, you know, there's a net of 9 million more being raised, but there's a net of 17 additional million being incremental funds raised.
Yep. So the reason for that is that we've already.
Why do we think that the unrestricted is going down, and why don't those numbers add up?
Yeah, it's just because we've already raised money in 2020 that we don't confidently project forward into 2021, you know, we've had, and so let me just give a little backstory, which also answers another question from you. You know, we have had the experience of having unexpected $1 million plus donations come in. In 2019, we moved more than $12 million to charities that came from a single donor we hadn't met before 2019. And already in 2020, we've received $9.6 million from two donors that, you know, we didn't previously have a relationship with. And so, you know, based on past experience, we expect some degree of large funding to come in from donors we don't previously know. But you know, we don't project that continuing at the level that it has for just 2019 and 2020. And so therefore, we project our incremental needs that we expect to recur to be higher than, you know, than what, you know, because we don't expect, sorry, all the money from that we'd raised in 2020 to come back in 2021.
So I want to make sure I understand this. I'm not sure if you think that you've answered the question about the unattributed organic.
Nope, have not answered that question yet. So on unattributed organic, I mean, we've seen historically that GiveWell Money Moved has roughly grown by like in the range of 10% per year. It's bounced around a ton over the last few years because it can be very driven by like a very small number of very large gifts in any given year. But roughly speaking, around, you know, 10% per year is what we've seen. And that's been without proactive work on marketing. And so I think it's reasonable to project that that will continue to some extent. And so that's what, you know, when we look at our outreach goals, like we expect even in the absence of our taking any action, you know, we would continue to move some money. And we expect that that will be increased by money that marketing and fundraising help to drive that we can't directly attribute to their activities. I'm gonna, you know, I'm just gonna pause in between questions so people have a chance to jump in, but there's no need to jump in, but obviously feel free to do so. The last question on the definitions was a question, Buddy, you asked, which was just asking for a little more information about, you know, how the targets for marketing, major gifts and organic were set, and, you know, what did we benchmark against to get there? So I'm gonna let Jim and then Steph, you know, answer for their projections.
As far as how we set the goals and spend by category for 2020, you know, we largely looked to two things. First, we had pretty good success in podcasts last year. We invested about $150,000 and received over $550,000 in revenue. We think that's such a phenomenal result that our first priority was to expand our efforts there, put more money into podcasts, get more assistance in the podcast industry through some professional help, a podcast agency, Oxford Road. Then the question was, where do we go next with channels? And digital felt like the best choice for a few reasons. First, because of the success GiveWell's had over the past decade, we have a starting list that can serve as a phenomenal asset, both in Facebook and Google universes, from which to model new donors. And as we're getting a better understanding of who our donors are, as well as who they could be, leveraging these lists in the short term gives us a shortcut to doing that through their algorithms. We also felt that digital had a few advantages. First, it's very nimble. We put dollars in quickly, we can take dollars out quickly based on performance. It also allows for much better testing. Whereas podcasts, even with its great success, one of the disadvantages is it's offline. So you're always a little bit challenged in getting test purity out of it. So we think digital offers both of those benefits. Additionally, digital is just part of the complement of channels we want to have at the ready, especially during donation season. I think it would be a mistake to go in and try to get those channels off the ground between October and the end of the year and have them in their best position to harvest the demand that we're creating during donation season. So we want to move on them sooner. We know that our tests will be depressed compared to the same efforts done during donation season, but we still feel like we put valuable tests in, hone our targeting, hone our messaging, get those channels in a place that when donation season hits, we're able to deploy them at much higher levels of profitability. Now, hopefully we'll find out that along the way, they're still profitable. We'll lower our ROI expectations But if we notice that they're profitable, then that should inform our 2021 plan and how we spend money throughout the year to maximize growth and donations. We're also looking at where other charities spend a lot of their marketing. Something like direct mail is certainly on the short list of channels that we want to experiment with, but given its lead times, typically has a pretty hefty front-end cost, and you really want to be exceptional in direct mail in modeling out your target universe, especially for new donors. I felt it was a little premature to go after that aggressively during this off-cycle period over the next couple of months. But as we learn more about our audience, we're hopeful to get that off the ground in Q4, at least on a test basis, to see how direct mail can play in driving growth. I'll pause there, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Jim. Just one follow-up question. I mean, do we have a sense of who are the best in class nonprofits at raising funds for like these three major buckets, and what parts of their fundraising strategies would adapt well to the GiveWell product versus not? I'd just be curious to hear more about like how we've thought about GiveWell, which obviously has very distinct characteristics to a lot of nonprofits that raise a bunch of money, but I'm sure there's a lot to learn there as well.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think we as a company to do more research on what other tactics are being deployed by larger nonprofits. You know, we see companies that we like their style and their approach in advertising. Some of those look like the Charity Waters or the End Funds. We also see a lot of large players that just have much more established brands, and they take convenience with their advertising approach because of the brand is more known, and they can, I think, lean on their core advertising a bit more aggressively. I think we need to go out because we're seeing success in something like podcasts, which I can't point to many or any other nonprofits that are extensively using podcasts. I feel like we're getting signal that maybe we're going to behave a bit differently. The channels that look a little bit more like consumer-facing products can be successful for GiveWell. So that's the model we're largely pursuing this year, while we also look to what other companies are doing and try to inform 2021 strategies with some of their best practices.
I, for one, am looking forward to my GiveWell mailing labels.
Steph, will you talk a little bit also about the research you did and the benchmarking against other fundraising organizations, and also thinking about us relative to higher ed fundraising?
Sure. Yeah. So we looked into like our peers, the kind of Doctors Without Borders, your UNICEF USA. Who else was it? Let's have a look. I can't even recall now what the other ones were. Save the Children, IRC, all of the kind of usual suspects. And I think like in terms of benchmarking what they raise, like they're probably in the realm of like 500 million moved annually compared to us, which is like 140 million moved annually. The biggest difference, I think, in the where the dollars come from are they have a lot of like government and multilateral income that we just don't have. Maybe Buddy will change that. And then the other areas in terms of how I guess for acquisition that we differ, they do a lot of like that street canvassing, and that's probably something that we might not ever consider doing, but that's one difference. And then in terms of like fundraising, traditional fundraising tactics, the biggest differences are they move a lot more money from institutional donors, so corporations and foundations. And the other area is planned giving. So every year they're realizing bequests in the order of $100 million plus. And so we're just a much younger institution with younger donors. And certainly that is two areas that we want to focus on, corporations, like institutional giving and planned giving, in years two and three of the fundraising program. They just take a lot longer to yield results. And so... It's not sort of an immediate focus for 2020, But yeah, they're two areas. In terms of like the targets that we do have for 2020 in fundraising, I focused more internally to project those out. Most other nonprofits don't really approach sort of measuring the impact of outreach initiatives and interventions on a counterfactual basis. They kind of look at the whole pie. So it's kind of hard to benchmark against kind of their fundraising targets when we're looking at things a little bit more minutely. But if you force some benchmarks in terms of like cost versus income, so that's like a pretty reasonable benchmark. But in terms of the actual targets that are in this document that we were speaking about, you know, I based that on the fact that last year we kind of ran a traditional fundraising major gifts sort of asking strategy and closed $1 million of incremental gifts between August and December. Well, I guess January 31. And so sort of, I guess I just extrapolated from there what would be reasonable. And given that major gifts is all about building long-term relationships and it often takes 12 to 24 months to sort of see a big gift come out of that sort of 12 months or 24 months of work. That's why the kind of line is not quite linear. It kind of dips up for a bit more of a exponential growth over 2021 and 2022. So most of the fundraising targets are very much based on internal data.
So moving on to just some more questions. A question, Holden, that you asked was, you know, in our targets, it's clear that our money moved expectations for marketing over the next few years are noticeably lower than what we anticipate from organic and fundraising. And so how are we thinking about, you know, investing in marketing on that basis? So just very briefly, I'd say, you know, we expect that, you know, first off, marketing will be ROI positive by, you know, year two of investment. And by that, I mean, we will track more money move than we've like spent on advertising and staff in that area. And then I think it's important to note that the table understates the impact of marketing in two really important ways that are just like hard to estimate. So first is just, and you know, you nodded to this in your question, like marketing just plays an important role in bringing in new donors that can eventually go through our retention program and are the prospects that can end up being, or I should say giving major donations in the future. And so, you know, I think that probably doesn't happen on the timescale of, you know, the 2 years that we're projecting out or the 3 years we're projecting out here, but over a longer time frame, that should start to work as we get the retention side really working. And then the other is that I think marketing will play a big role in unattributed money moved. So, you know, we don't track dollars or we can't track marketing's effect on dollars that go directly to AMF or Give Directly. I mean, we can track some of those dollars overall. A lot of those dollars we can't track at all. But the only thing we're able to track is when people give directly through us. And so there's this, you know, essentially increased amount of money that it's moving that's beyond the scope of what, you know, we're even able to track.
It might be interesting at some point to have metrics kind of reflecting the life cycle of donors where it could be like, you know, this year we had X amount of new dollars and then we had Y amount of like dollars from three-year-old donors or three plus year old donors or something. And then you can kind of get a sense of where things are going that like, you know, you're kind of, you added a certain number of new dollars and you have a sense that new dollars are going to be worth more than a dollar down the line. That's just a thought.
Yeah, we definitely want to have that. And I'd say at the moment we know that sort of the future value of $1 given this year is around, you know, 90 cents to a dollar each future year.
Right.
And we, you know, if we, Steph, if you do your job really well, then like our expectation is that number goes up over time.
Right.
Okay. So another question, Buddy, that you had was around investing in identifying new major donors. So, you know, we spoke a lot about sort of the marketing side of trying to acquire like new retail donors primarily. Steph's plan focuses on retaining and increasing the donation levels of existing donors? And so, yeah, how are we thinking about that new sort of cold or new major donors? And Steph, do you want to talk about
that a little bit? Yeah, I think it's mainly a function of just like prioritization that isn't, you know, in the 2020 plan at the moment. In my past experience, I think that going after sort of high net worth prospects can sometimes be a bit of a red herring, in that, you know, you invest a lot of time, you chase people that you think, you know, they're into Partners in Health. Of course they would be into GiveWell. Let's like go after them. And sometimes it's just a lot of time invested and not necessarily a lot of return. And then I think where it does work very well in terms of prospecting high net worth individuals, sorry, not individuals, just high net worth donors, is institutional donors, when there's like a bit more of a finite list. So you can kind of put all of the foundations on a piece of paper, put all of the corporations that exist on a piece of paper, you know, go through public information about their CSR strategies and see what aligns, and you can actually come up with strategies to get in front of them. And that probably will yield better results, just because compared to individuals, you kind of, it's a never ending list and it's just a lot harder. So in terms of individuals, I think that where we would want to develop the strategy in, you know, the next sort of 2 or 3 years would be just leveraging kind of our internal networks a lot better for referrals. So, you know, we currently do it in a kind of opportunistic way and not very strategic way, where if we have a good relationship with a major donor, you know, who is open to the idea of introducing GiveWell to their friends that they think might be receptive, you know, we'll go down that path. We can certainly be more systematic about that in the future, and, you know, create opportunities for people to bring their friends along to things. I'm not advocating big galas, don't worry, but something of a smaller nature.
Cool. Great. Thanks, Steph. I wanted to make sure that we keep moving through the questions to make sure we get to some of the questions that were on some other documents, and in particular, we're going to miss a few of the questions that some folks asked on some of these documents, but we can come back to them after if folks are interested. So there was a bunch of questions from Tim and Carrie on the tactics in the donor retention document. So I think I wanted to move to that now and address those. And so this was in reference to, you know, we wrote in the, or Steph, you know, in her plan wrote that, you know, we want to create special giving opportunities for major donors who like and expect to own special projects. I think Carrie and Tim, you both kind of questioned how this is consistent with GiveWell's sort of normal operating procedure and brand. So I think it would be worth talking a little bit about that now.
Shall I?
Yeah, Steph, why don't you kick off, and then Carrie and Tim, you know, please jump in with any follow-ups.
Yeah, no, like that's a very good question to flag, and rightly so. And I think it's a very tricky balance to strike, but definitely something I think we should try to do. I think special giving opportunities definitely goes against the kind of democratic approach that GiveWell has. You know, we put our research out free for everyone to use. Anyone's dollar has the same impact. And like, I want to be as true to that, I guess, value as possible, while at the same time being able to really take advantage of accelerating people's giving and having more impact and moving more money. The reason I think it's a really valuable thing to do, I think it's actually one of the most valuable things we can do, is that when I first came, I certainly tried to go down that route of like just trying to increase people based on asking them for more money. And it was sort of difficult to inspire donors on incremental impact in a way that didn't compare to my previous experience, when you could inspire donors by projects that they enabled. You know, there wasn't that sense of ownership that they enabled something to happen that maybe otherwise wouldn't have happened. And so, you know, when you pitch something like each
incremental $3,000 will save some kind of unspecified life, that was just less tangible than saying, you know, if you could give $1 million to save X lives in Z village, it just became a lot more tangible and sort of a bit more motivating from that donor's perspective. And I think it would be a missed opportunity, you know, not to try and draw boxes around some of the giving opportunities and funding gaps that we currently have at our top charities and perhaps even at incubation grantees, and try to pitch those to donors as a way of really accelerating what they're willing to give to give well. I think the other reason that it's important for us to explore this in a cautious way is that our top charities and other meta EA groups are doing this with donors. They're pitching donors in the same way that I'm proposing that we pitch donors. And it's often with a very positive spin because they're pitching themselves. And I think that there is a nice space for GiveWell as a recommender, a trusted advisor, to be presenting funding opportunities, what's and all, pluses, minuses, risks, et cetera. And I think as we've done it so far, as we've rolled out this strategy so far, I think people have been receptive. I'm certainly happy to share like some of the written proposals that we've sent to donors that are these kind of more special giving opportunities. You know, one example is we pitched some donors on potentially funding a maternal syphilis program that we're thinking of we're in the final stages of research on. We also pitched folks on specific funding gaps at AMF. And then we also pitched folks to provide matching funds for our marketing tests last year. And yeah, as you, I'm happy to share it with you, but we really go through the funding opportunities in a, I think, a very GiveWellian way, a really upfront with kind of all the risks that are associated with it, the pluses, the minuses. And I think that we're probably doing it a lot better than our peers or our top charities going directly to our major donors. Yeah. Does that allay those reservations or exacerbate them?
So for what it's worth, Stephanie and I had this conversation when we met at the last board meeting. And I have seen some of the ways that it's marketed. I was less concerned after I had seen some of the actual language that's used. Stephanie, I think one thing here is that if this said create special giving messages instead of mm-hmm. opportunities, it would ring fewer alarm bells for a lot of us because there is a messaging around it versus the we are creating a giving opportunity that's not available to other people. We're doing custom research that we're not going to tell other people about, that sort of thing. You know, I do think Carrie is probably specifically attuned to this, and I think rightly so, because the counterfactual is often going to be open fill will fund this gap if it doesn't get funded, and making sure open fill is comfortable with that, the way those messages are presented, so it doesn't actually misrepresent, you know, that would be a concern of mine, is, you know, this ongoing thing about how we present what the counterfactual in those messages are, mm-hmm. And it doesn't misrepresent our other donors, because mm-hmm. eventually they're going to talk to each other, and if we run the risk of people saying, wait, what? That's going to be really, really bad for the brand.
Yeah, I guess in terms of like the counterfactual, I find that a really tricky question to answer, because in the conversations I've had with donors, they just don't seem to either understand or care about that element. I think like even really kind of committed EAs who do grasp this idea that I'm just displacing somebody else's money that will eventually go to AMF instead of my money, because I'm funding this incubation grant instead of open fill. I still think they just like the idea that they can say, this is this cool project that I'm attached to. And it doesn't, even if they intellectually understand that, I don't think it changes the motivation or the decision too much. And it's just not something, I guess, that we've focused on a lot in our conversations with donors, and it's something I could certainly do more thoroughly if that's the desire. But I just don't think donors really latch onto it in a way that maybe internally at GiveWell, it's so top of mind.
I don't want to tell you what to do at all. But you know, one thing that I find, one reason I trust GiveWell so much is because they go out of their way to explain that, you know, the fungibility aspect, and they think really hard about, you know, the counterfactual. And so I'm totally comfortable if, you know, a donor understands that actually the thing that they're causing to happen by paying for an incubation grant is like, we give more money to AMF. We're just making that example up, and I don't know if it's actually specifically relevant, but I'm totally comfortable with it if they know that's what's happening. And, so that's one reason why that stood out to me as kind of a little off-brand for GiveWell, is because one way that GiveWell has always distinguished itself in my eyes is being, you know, just extremely intellectually honest and, you know, maybe, you know, to a fault in terms of money moved, but I don't think ultimately to a fault, because it's so core, you know, to the identity and the reason why people are attracted to GiveWell.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely fair. And we certainly haven't prioritized, I think, that level of messaging in our pitching. And I wouldn't be against it, like being very explicit and including that information, purely because I don't think it will, as you said, prevent people from giving. It could, in fact, create even more affinity with the honesty and transparency of GiveWell. So, yeah, we can certainly incorporate that messaging a lot more explicitly.
Let me propose that we move on from this question. I think this is like a really challenging one, fungibility and how we communicate to donors, that we struggled a lot with. Tim, I see you struggled a lot with internally. Mm-hmm. And I think it may make sense to try and like have some of that discussion in a different forum, so we don't spend the rest of the time just on this topic, which I think we easily could do. And we agree it's like a very important, challenging question.
And I would just say, as long as you're thinking and talking about it, that I'm satisfied. I'm not gonna say that I like have the right answer or a specific, you know, instruction for you.
Yep, that makes sense. Thanks, Carrie.
And I concur too with that, as what Carrie was saying. The thing that I really care about and that I will continue to pay attention to is the GiveWell standard is not better than the other guys. The GiveWell standard is the Platonic ideal of transparency and truth-telling. And so giving ourselves a pass because other people don't do it as well as we do is not where we should be thinking. Our thinking is, how can we do the best that we possibly can, and not how much better is that? Is that incrementally better than somebody else who is doing deceptive stuff and we're not as deceptive as they are?
I agree with that.
Cool. And we agree here on the staff side as well. So I'd like to now move on to some of the questions about marketing tactics, just to make sure we have some time to get to them. I know that we're leaving some donor retention questions unanswered, and we'll just come back to those at the end, or more likely offline, to make sure that we can answer them. Sorry for jumping around, but I just want to make sure that we can get to all the different aspects of this meeting and the time that we have. So moving over to marketing, Tim, you had some sort of specific questions just about how we had like estimated things, why we were making decisions that we were, and what some of our estimates, where our forecast came from. And so let me just quickly say what those were, and then I'll turn it over to Jim to answer. So you had a question just about the...
Sarah Ellie, I think those are relatively easy things to follow up with offline. So okay. I would skip past those. The thing, if I had my druthers, and I, you know, other people can overrule me, some more of conversation around the donor profiles and the projections. If I am understanding where you're headed, like I'm not so worried about the returns on advertising, but like these ideas that we actually understand our donors and that they fit into these different profiles, and we've got this like I look at that donor research and I say there are no differences here, and I don't have any reason to believe that those characteristics are stable anyway. And then I see a plan that doesn't seem to match up that well with those donor profiles anyway. And so that's where, if we were going to spend some time, I would rather spend in, you know, sort of that domain.
It's fine with me. So let's just, you know, cover that. I think it may end up being the last question we answer, kind of pre-getting into the COVID specific stuff. But Jim, do you want to kind of address some of that just in terms of how we're thinking about the personas and how it informed your plan? And then Steph, maybe you could take it after Jim.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So I would take the initial personas as a somewhat artificial breakout of the current GiveWell donor. And I say it that way because our researcher, through both the donor satisfaction and donor deep dive research studies we conducted, tried to find clusters of behavior, especially around either what influences their decision to give or what degree of interaction they want the charity to have with them. Now, the reason I say it's a somewhat artificial breakout of the GiveWell donor is I think this will become more telling and probably shape what direction we go in the future as we take these same ideas or questions and we bring them to general populations. So the research we're conducting now is bringing similar questions to lapsed donors as well as non-donors, and then overlaying a much larger quant survey that starts to bump up against some of these psychographic and attitudinal questions to understand, like, is the GiveWell donor truly unique, that it's a 3% of audience? And yeah, there are these artificial breakouts of them, but it's still in one small region of the total addressable donor audience. Or are there other populations that we can go after? And how large are the populations that fit into the hand and heart, or the hands-off, the data-driven, and the hand and heart giver? So, you know, this is beginning data. It is starting to break out a little bit more knowledge about our consumer or our donors. I think it can inform some of our loyalty measures as far as how we interact with them going forward. But I think the greatest value will be when we measure them against the general donor universe. How big is our addressable audience, and how big are these micro audiences that we've identified as being highly relevant to GiveWell? Does that help, Tim?
It does. And, you know, just as a general principle, I've seen a whole lot of donor research. I've over time become much, much more skeptical about it, that these questions that we ask to assess and profile donors are not stable, and people change a lot week to week and month to month and year to year. And putting too much stock in that, I think, is a little worrisome. The follow-up question, though, is the on the retention plan. Is there a plan to sort of customize donor retention by these profiles? Because, you know, the thing that I'd raise there is almost everything in here and the donor retention plan seems to be directed at the characteristics described as a certain type of the donor, and would be bad things to do to people if they're a different kind of donor.
Well, real quick on that, so Steph, this is probably more in your world, but I think this idea of whether outreach tactics, which I think this really gets to the question about what could GiveWell do to increase your likelihood to give again in the future. And that looks like sharing information about the impact of your exact donation, or sharing the results that GiveWell has had more collectively with our portfolio. It's true that what we saw were answers that about 50% of people wanted that information, especially in the hands-off donor population. And about 50% of the population said it wouldn't increase their likelihood to give in the future more, right? What I can't speak to, we did not ask the negative of that question. Does this tactic make you less likely to give? Hands-off donors have exceptionally high likelihood to give again in the future. And if they're taking this question quite literally, you know, will this tactic make it more likely I give again in the future? But they are convinced they're going to give again in the future, then they may be answering no to that. That isn't to say they don't want those things, or they don't have find them at all valuable, or they don't find them as good vehicles to share. It just doesn't influence their likelihood to give again in the future. So what we did see is most people did embrace these things, especially when we get into some of the qual, when we're asking people about what else they would like to know. They do highlight these, but it tends to be something more in the back end of their experience as opposed to informing whether or not they want to get behind a charity. So, you know, I think what we need to do is be very GiveWell and analytical and reason forward with new donors, and then use these tactics to help improve our relationship with existing donors, and hopefully also encourage them to share if we make these outputs more digestible, something that can be more universally shared by our donors.
Yeah, and in terms of the overlap with the retention plan, Tim, you know, currently it is absent, that overlap. That's why it read that way. It certainly was intended to be that way. So in terms of major gifts and mid-level donors, you know, we shouldn't actually think of those people in persona types. We should actually know those people personally through one-on-one relationships. So that's why they don't apply there. And for the mass market, you know, they may eventually be very useful to overlay. But as I mentioned before, we currently just don't know enough about the 44,000 people that we're targeting for mass donor retention to be able to correctly assign them to one persona or another. So right now, it's just something we can't act on because it would just be a total random guess. You know, what we plan to do this year is, you know, now that we have the research about those, you know, preferences, we can start to test messaging across our segments and then track behaviours and see if they match up to those personas. So, you know, did they respond to an emotional appeal? Did they click on a link that took them to a very deep research article and spend some time there? Did they not open a single email that we sent them all year? You know, once we can track those behaviours, then we can start to map those, you know, back to those personas and actually have that inform the retention plan moving forward. You know, you mentioned like there's a risk of backfiring those kind of hands-off donors if we're appealing to their hearts and minds with those tactics. You know, as Jim said, I don't think there's a huge risk there. You know, that number one, it's like a stated preference. I don't know that it necessarily matches to an actual, you know, revealed preference of how they might act when they receive communications that we're sending them. You know, over the last 12 months, I've, you know, had several experiences of people saying, you know, I like to watch from afar, don't worry, I know what you're doing. And then you mentioned in conversation, like, new incentives. How about that? I had no idea about that. And so I think that people really are open to receiving more information and more in-depth communications, but probably maybe not the way that they have in the past. So I think it's worth testing, you know, and I don't think that we're going to be, you know, doing anything wildly off-putting. You know, if somebody responds and unsubscribes or asks us not to email them, we can do that. I don't think it will turn people off in a way that is super risky. So I'm feeling sort of confident that's not too much of a risk.
You know, I'll throw out one more notion. We also don't know where our target audience evolves, right? Again, referencing back to these three populations, what we can't speak to is our hand and heart givers, 50% or 80% of the universe out there. And I think as we start to build that assessment, Tim, this would be especially concerning if hands-off donors really didn't want this thing and constituted the majority of our current population and the majority of our target population. But it could be that with hand and heart at 60% and data-driven deciders at 70% on something like sharing impact of donation, you know, if those universe of those populations are significantly larger than the hands-off, then one could argue in the future, these strengthen our relationship with consumers because we presumably may get more people like them as opposed to the hands off. So I think it's a little early to determine whether these are harmful or helpful, but I think to Stephanie's point, we should, you know, tread cautiously, choose the things that are more universally wanted, and then measure religiously to see if we're creating any negative behaviors that we don't want.
Any other questions that people really want to make sure to hit on outreach before we just move to some of the COVID things? And of course, we can always come back if we have extra time, but if there's anything that is really pressing, now'd be a good time to raise it. Okay, great. And apologies if you hear the background noise. Someone is gardening outside my window here and it's very loud on my side. Anyhow, I wanted to briefly touch on some of the COVID related questions. They're very brief and then we'll see where we are. So, you know, what we've seen so far in 2020, or I should say like since the end of February when the stock market started to sell off and the pandemic became more salient, you know, our donations have basically been flat overall. Holden, you asked about seeing that in a more like granular way, like it bounces around month to month. We'll just share that, I think, after in our follow-up. But, you know, interestingly, like it seems, you know, fairly stable. And so while we've made these projections, I think our best guess would have to be like, we'll be on our projections for this year. And that's, you know, even better than what we've projected and, you know, in even the limited scenario. But you know, we can share more data on that. And, you know, Whitney and the finance part of the operations team are going to be like tracking this closely on an ongoing basis. You know, and in particular, you know, thinking about what we're, you know, as we make new decisions this year about people to hire, being sure that we're thoughtful and sensitive to the fact that we're de facto committing to those costs in 2021 and, making sure that we're watching that carefully so that those, you know, we don't overcommit spending relative to what we, you know, we believe we can confidently afford. Norma, a question that you sent through, which I thought was a good question, is that maybe, I don't know if it'll spark some discussion, is just around how could COVID change the opportunities that GiveWell is able to identify and recommend in 2020? And, you know, what would we do in a world in which we found substantially less room for more funding at our top charities than at like, I don't know, perhaps lower cost effectiveness levels than, you know, we did in 2019 or we might expect in 2021 or 2022. You know, we've done a little bit of analysis on that front. You know, Natalie led this, focused on the top charities. We do think we're going to have, our top charities will have less room for more funding this year than they would have had in a normal year. So then they will, let's say in 2022. And you know, our best guess is that if that happens, you know, we're more likely to hold money or like recommend less money to donors, you know, rather than distribute funds at much lower levels of cost effectiveness. You know, we're sort of like, we're full speed ahead on trying to identify opportunities that we think are very cost effective, you know, in existing top charities, new top charities, looking at COVID specific grant making. But in a world in which, you know, this year looks like a year in which we really can't identify as much highly cost effective room for more funding, you know, we'd be inclined to hold the money and give later because we think that that would end up, you know, helping more people to a greater extent.
Thanks, Sally. That's really helpful context. And one question that sparks is how that intersects with the fundraising conversation that we just had, and particularly as things get closer to giving season, but even in the interim with the outreach to high net worth individuals and things like that, if there's any sort of particular messaging around that you see, or even if this is some opportunities around what you mentioned around the goal of unrestricted funding and sort of pitching GiveWell having a stable foundation base to sort of build on might be something that one could do in those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could affect how we reach out to donors. You know, my guess is that, you know, one of the ways that this will filter through is, on sort of the GiveWell side specifically, like through the fund that, you know, we re-grant to top charities at our discretion. And, you know, right now we've held some funds that came in earlier this year longer than we normally would, due to the uncertainty of, you know, where those funds will be needed most. You know, we've communicated about that to donors. And I think that, like, in the, you know, the amount that fund receives is within the range of, you know, what difference we expect in terms of Charities Room for More Funding, you know, later this year.
Ellie, could you talk a little bit more about the, you know, when you wrote this several weeks ago, you thought that the COVID-specific related research would last for another 6 weeks. I think that was 3 weeks ago. Are we then at, yeah, we really do think we've exhausted what those people can do and they're going to wrap that up, or has that perspective changed?
Yeah, that's changed a little bit. We are going, you know, right now we're, you know, this is, I'd say that the COVID related research has been just extremely challenging. It's challenging for GiveWell because it's, you know, a different type of research and giving than like GiveWell has primarily done. You know, most of our giving relates to, you know, getting really deep into very high quality evidence and understanding it and organizations' track records well. So it's just, you know, something that like we're not as experienced with. And then like literally the sort of reality is hard to pin down in terms of like what, how much funding is going where and how impactful different opportunities are. And so that's made it challenging. But I think that we're probably going to continue on longer in trying to evaluate like what opportunities exist. And that's not because we have, you know, all of a sudden we have not yet found like many opportunities that we're exceptionally excited about. But there are also a lot of areas that we just don't feel like we've sufficiently explored, and we'd like to more explicitly explore them and compare them to where we could, you know, otherwise be researching. And sort of, I don't have that list at the sort of at my fingertips, but we're planning to do a more thorough, you know, more comprehensive look at, you know, what the opportunities are than I thought we would when I put this document together a few weeks ago.
You know, for what it's worth, I do very much align with the, I think there are going to be some really fabulous opportunities. You know, fabulous, I guess is a wrong word, high impact opportunities over the course of the next 18 months because of the level of disruption that I'm seeing in the various research studies that I'm following, that that there is, you know, value in keeping money in reserve for those opportunities. And, you know, just a quick example of like the numbers of people who have left urban areas in the developing world is huge. And they're going to deplete all of the resources in their home villages because of that. A revival of something like No Lean Season that helps those people get back to urban areas 9 months from now could potentially, you know, be one of these things. And if, you know, people aren't, you know, lots of opportunities in, you know, repurposing programs towards the rural areas where these people now are, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I'm not like saying, okay, I know that this is, but, you know, it seems to me there are going to be a lot of things like that that come along. And so, you know, having a stance that prepares us to be, you know, funding those opportunities as they come up, I think is the right overall strategic alignment.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're definitely, trying to you know, keep looking for things, investigating the things that seem promising. You know, I don't know how long that will go on, but at the very least, it puts us in this position where we're both critically thinking about those opportunities relative to what we would otherwise be giving to, and in a position where, you know, people are reaching out to us and we're hearing from them when there are opportunities that seem promising to them.
Ellie, this might be a terrible idea, but I'm going to float it anyway. Sort of akin to the comment Holden made earlier about, you know, how is Steph networking, her benchmarking? Would it be possibly useful to let board members know, like, kind of what outreach we've done to identify some of these opportunities, such that if they in their respective networks and work stumble across something, I mean, probably they might think of us anyway if it seemed like it was really well suited to GiveWell, but to be able to have sort of some overlap and awareness on both sides there of things that we've already looked into and like crossed off the list, and or future things that seem like they would be high potential that we've thought about if people find them or find, you know, organizations that are doing that.
Yeah, I guess I would just say have a low bar for sending things our way. Like we've, you know, here, like we, you know, James and Michael, who are both kind of full-time on this work, are trying to talk to like a ton of people and, you know, all the usual suspects across like many different domains. You know, Norma and Buddy, we've talked to both of you as well. You know, James is in touch with the folks at OpenPhil as well. So, I mean, I would just say like, don't hesitate to send anything our way because we're getting a ton of stuff inbound already. I mean, if you'd like to see a list of the people we've talked to, I mean, we're happy to pull it together. It's just probably going to be a long list of the usual suspects. But yeah, I mean, we're very like actively engaged, or I should say like James and Michael that are very actively engaged. And so just like have an especially low bar for shooting stuff our way. Whitney, should we move
anything
to-
else on? Sorry, go ahead, Tim.
We were both going to, well, that was me. We were both going to say the same thing. I was going to say, Whitney, should we move to the votes to make sure that we keep those?
Yep, exactly. So just as a quick refresher, we just have two items for vote this meeting, and we were going to vote on them in aggregate. The first was our recommendation that the board authorize the CEO to sign, to approve grants up to a total of $1 million in support of our mission each year at his discretion from funds that are restricted to grant making at GiveWell's discretion. And the other was just approving the minutes from the February board meeting. So I will put those out there. And would anyone like to make a motion to vote?
I will move that we vote on the CEO grant making authorization.
I second the motion.
I'll call a vote. This is Tim Ogden, and I approve. Julia?
Julia Weiss, I approve.
Holden?
Holden, you're muted.
Just didn't see the mute. Yeah, I approve.
Carrie?
I approve.
Ellie?
I approve.
Motion passes. Wonderful. I'd now like to move that we approve the minutes for the last board meeting.
Seconded. That's the thing that happens to.
We'll move to a vote. Tim Ogden approves. Julia?
Approve.
Holden?
Approve.
Carrie?
I approve.
Ellie?
I approve.
Okay, we've taken care of that part.
Excellent. Thanks, everybody. Unanimous approval of both.
So I'll comment here. Like, there are some questions that I think is worthwhile to follow up with. I think, you know, obviously we have as a board shown that we care about GiveWell's messaging. And so I think that will be something that on an ongoing basis we'll want to be thinking about, and we'll look forward to some of the metrics that come along from Jim and Stephanie, your work. It's, at least speaking for myself, it's very impressive how much the marketing and fundraising has improved at GiveWell in a short amount of time since you guys have been dedicated to it. So please understand that we do care about this and we'll want to be engaged, but this is marked material positive progress since the 10 years that I've been involved in GiveWell. I think this board meeting worked really well. Ellie and I had a number of conversations and Whitney had a number of conversations about how to structure board meetings to be more effective. And I'm pretty happy with the way this one went. I want to encourage any of the other board members, if you want to reach out to me directly with other feedback on how exactly this one worked and what we might be able to do to make it work a little bit better. Ellie, I will say the one thing that I struggled with is it was hard to keep track of where we were in the questions and how they related to the documents. And so I don't think it's necessary to produce a document with the answers first, but a document that sort of like that we can follow along with a little bouncing ball or where we are in the discussion and what questions I think would be helpful in future board meetings, just to, so it's clear which questions are being answered and which questions we're skipping, I think would be a useful thing. Sure. Let me open the floor there for other input, either on the structure of the board meeting, any other questions that people want to follow up on, any other ideas on how we can make board meetings better, more useful, and more efficient. Norma, thank you for joining us.
I might have some thoughts on this, but I want to gather them and follow up over email, so I don't want to be taken as saying there's nothing. But, yeah.
Norma, thank you for joining us. We hope it wasn't too scary.
Not at all.
Buddy, good to have you here. And what is it, July 1st is still the date we're looking at?
Yeah, we're nailing it down, but probably July 8th after the 4th of July weekend.
Great. When
is your last day at ID Insight?
My last day is tomorrow. Well, I think technically June 1st, Monday, but really tomorrow. So I've been pretty busy wrapping that up and excited for the next chapter and really awesome, Jim and Steph, to hear from you guys today.
Congratulations. Hope it's not too bittersweet.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's saying goodbye or something like that when you can't actually even see any of the people.
Yeah, exactly.
But on that note, I will go ahead and this is the last call for anything before I officially adjourn. Anyone? Okay, I am officially adjourning this board meeting of GiveWell. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Whitney, for your excellent facilitation, as always.
I felt very hands-off this particular meeting.
All right, thanks, everyone.
Very good. Good to see everyone, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.